Hello and welcome to Press TV News Analysis. I'm Kaveh Taghvai. Since the protests began in Bahrain in mid-February, at least 27 anti-regime protesters have been killed, and that's on paper. But it's the serious human rights violations, such as the excessive use of force and extrajudicial killings, as reported by the Bahrain Center of Human Rights, from Saudi-backed Bahraini forces, that has led not only to the condemnation of this U.S.-backed regime, but also the United States itself, not to mention the lack of action by the international community. We'll discuss this more. Our guests include political analyst Dr. Ali Al-Kabani, who joins us from London. We also have chairman of the political science department over at Notre Dame University, Dr. Eugene Dabus, who joins us from Beirut. And also associate director of the Middle East Studies program at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, Jennifer Lowenstein. I want to thank all my guests. First, my guest in Beirut, Dr. Eugene Dabus. Given the human rights abuses, finally, the ILO, it's a UN agency, has proposed for Bahrain to clarify the scope of their power, and specifically why, under state of national safety, as they say, it lacks limits on the security forces' behavior. It's good for them to come out, but what about the follow-up? What's going to happen?
Well, traditionally, international norms in the Arab world have been embraced and then rarely implemented properly. So it's not surprising that they would come out with new suggestions for respecting human rights, documenting the same. But we, as we say, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And I sincerely doubt that they're going to live up to those claims or those promises. However, this does give us the leverage to measure them. If they claim to use Western standards or international standards, I prefer to say, then at least we can see the ambiguity or the disparity between their promises and their actual actions.
Well, let's continue further with not only the U.S. and the European inaction in Bahrain. Dr. Kabani, I want to look at the European inaction. Robert Cooper, a handpicked senior advisor to Catherine Ashton, the EU's foreign policy chief, as you well know, publicly defended Bahrain's brutal crackdown and chalked up the deaths as accidents. This was around March 30th. So is that the type of reaction we're seeing from the EU, in particular, obviously a reflection of European countries?
Actually, what you are hearing from the EU and from the United States is a lip talk and media talk to say that they are the guardian of human rights and they support human rights. And the contradiction is in the statement of Hillary Clinton when she says that the Bahraini government have got the sovereign right to invite the GCC forces. How can a sovereign country, which lost legitimacy because the majority of its people do not want this government in place, can invite foreign armies to fight civilians and to crush a civilian protest? So that is the hypocrisy of the United States when they say that the Bahraini government have got the sovereign right, and at the same time that they wish that the process will end peacefully and amicably. We can see that the Bahraini government stopped any dialogue with the opposition, and they are now feeling strong after they dispersed all the protesters from the Pearl Square, and they are committing really crimes against humanity under the watch of the Fifth Fleet of the United States, which is based in Bahrain.
Well, that is a big question, isn't it? The U.S. involvement, whether
really
they gave a green light. And I'm sorry to come in here, but let me get a response from our U.S. guest on that. Jennifer Lowenstein, I mean, this is the piece of news that perhaps may explain the U.S. stance, and that is you invade Bahrain, we take out Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, which is reportedly a deal struck between Barack Obama and Saudi Arabia. And two diplomatic sources have said at the UN to have confirmed that Washington gave the go-ahead for Saudi Arabia to invade Bahrain.
Well, of course, I don't have any inside information on that. But when I heard the news, my first thought was that the U.S. had just given a green light to the Saudis to go into Bahrain. And in fact, I believe Robert Gates was there the day before the invasion. And as I said, I can't speak from knowing internal records, but it looks very suspicious to me. Bahrain and Libya both are vital interests to the United States, despite what Obama and his administration are saying. And to think of this as somehow we're just trying to help settle the unrest in the region, and we'd like to see democracy and freedom in both places, it's completely naive. It's absolutely naive. I mean, the truth is, we want the Bahraini monarchy to stay in power. And I do believe the United States has thrown in its lot with the rebels in Libya, but that has a lot to do with history of Libya and the United States and the oil corporations there.
Dr. Dabous, Robert Gates is in Saudi Arabia, this being his third trip to the region this past month, and he's there echoing, as it's been stated, the sentiments of Hillary Rodham Clinton, which has been cautioning the Arab governments on the risk of moving too slowly. Now, that could be taken two ways, and I'd like to find out your response, because if the United States has given the green light, is it meaning moving too slowly in terms of the crackdown, or settling the situation there? Or are they talking about the reforms?
Well, as I said on your show before, I think that the U.S. does have a genuine interest in democratic reform, because democratic reform is closely linked to economic reform. And the entire region is trailing the rest of the world in both. Obviously, once you loosen up the screws, as we see happening in Syria or possibly in Jordan as well, there's a danger of a response, a takeover from undemocratic forces, the old saying, one man, one vote, one time. This is obviously something the U.S. is very much worried about, but I think now they've realized that supporting regimes that have been in power for 30, 40 years is a greater liability than the risk they need to take to allow a democratic process, especially because the economic power remains in the hands of American allies.
And moving on to figuring out what this relationship is, Dr. Kabbani, I mean, what is it that defines the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia as we speak? Certain reports indicating that there was a rift, but then this trip saying that Gates is there to make sure that the $60 billion arms deal is going through, not to mention that he's there trying to sell the Saudi Arabia more equipment at the same time. So what is it that the United States is asking Saudi Arabia to do, or what is defining the relationship as we speak regarding the events, in this case, in Point Bahrain?
The relationship between the Saudi monarchy and the United States is very strong and very stable. And the King of Saudi Arabia, he knows that his monarchy is relying on the protection and the support of the United States. So they may have some disagreement sometimes on a regional issue, but they never have disputes, and the Saudi government will never afford to have a dispute against the Americans. But I think the Americans now are trying to convince the Saudis that the days of Ali Abdullah Saleh is over and they shouldn't support his regime, and now it's a time for a change in Yemen. Change of faces, but not regime. This is what the U.S. and the Saudi kingdom are trying to plot in Yemen. As for Bahrain, it's a public knowledge. The American administration announced that the Bahraini regime is a pillar of the military and strategic framework of the United States in the area. So regardless of how brutal and authoritarian this regime is, the United States and Saudi Arabia will support this regime to the end, because they are going against the wish of the majority of the people. They don't care about the legitimate demands. And this, by the way, legitimate demands is their words, not mine, of the Bahraini people. But they are supporting the regime, and they allowed and they give a green light for Dar al Jazeera, the Peninsula Shield forces, to really invade Bahrain to help the dictator of Bahrain in oppressing and crushing the protest in the country.
Okay.
And we could hear the assistant of the defense secretary of Saudi Arabia today saying that Bahrain is stable. If that situation is stable, according to assistant defense secretary of Saudi Arabia, so the guy is living in his dreams and he doesn't know really what's going around him.
Well, that's how some media have reported the way the crackdown has occurred, that it has suppressed and therefore stopped the momentum. But in terms of the role of the media, Jennifer Lowenstein, let's look at the way the United States has portrayed this within the states. The White House has done everything, hasn't it, to make sure that the Bahrain drama is buried by U.S. media. Well, then why doesn't the UN-approved R2P...
Yeah, we are hearing...
Go ahead.
We are hearing nothing, basically, about Bahrain anymore. Everything is more or less coming to us about Libya, about Yemen, about ongoing developments in Egypt. But as far as Bahrain is concerned, it's been buried. When it was in the news, there was an attempt to make this into a Sunni-Shia split and to blame Iran, saying that it was Iran's fault and was trying to stir up dissent among Bahrain's Shia population, and that therefore it was necessary to send in Saudi troops. This is a very dangerous game that the U.S. is playing, if that's what they're doing, because I think it's in nobody's interest to have any kind of regional tension between Saudi Arabia and Iran, and it would not surprise me in the least if to find out that the United States and Saudi Arabia are trying to provoke Iran so that they have an excuse to go and destroy its economic and political infrastructure.
Well, in terms of the role of Iran, I mean, aside from any factual evidence coming through, which the United States recently did not present any, and said that the, Iran is doesn't have a role in general of any of the uprisings. They're talking about interference when, at the same time, in Bahrain, you have Saudi soldiers coming through and supporting the Bahraini forces. And, of course, we see what has unfolded. So, Dr. Dabos, how is that? That
seems
like...
And we have to remember...
Go ahead, Jennifer.
I was just going to say, I missed some of this because the sound was cut, but we have to remember that last fall the Saudis received an unprecedented $60 billion in military hardware from the United States. It doesn't need that. There's no reason for it. It's probably nothing more than recycled petrodollars, and it sustains a military-industrial complex between the United States and Saudi Arabia that has been present since just after the Second World War. I have a very bad feeling about this. I am sure that the Bahraini uprising is not over, and that the people in Bahrain who were demonstrating, both Sunni and Shia together, against the repressive monarchy, would really like to see some kind of reform possible without this turning into a full-scale regional or global war.
Well, let me bring in Dr. Dabus. Dr. Dabus, I mean, we talk about how this has been blown up by Saudi Arabia for quite some time, and the United States in turn supporting them in terms of this interference coming from Iran. But of course, Iran has not only denied any type of interference. Iran is saying, first of all, what does that have to do with the role that you guys are playing, meaning the Bahraini forces backed by Saudi forces, along with the legitimate demands of Bahrainis when it comes to just what they need, which is a lifting of their economic status and, of course, the repression that has occurred. So there is a disconnect there in terms of the reasoning by Saudi Arabia and the United States, isn't there?
Well, I think we do have to admit that Iran, as the major Shia power in the region and in the world, does have a responsibility to champion the interests of the Shia population in countries like Bahrain, in Saudi Arabia, in Lebanon. And the ties are very close. And to deny this would, I think, not only be not factual, but also wouldn't help the discussion whatsoever, because most people do know it's true and it's legitimate. I think this is the important point. Whether that means that there is foreign intervention, military or financial, that nature, that's something that we don't have any proof of with the case of Saudi Arabia. There is some indication for Bahrain. But again, I would say this is to an extent legitimate. I think what's missing here, and it's interesting that we somehow have a parallel interest between the U.S. and Iran, is that countries like Bahrain and Yemen and Saudi Arabia itself are not doing enough to what we call co-opt the disadvantaged and oppressed minorities. Any good functioning democracy or dictatorship, for that matter, gives significant groups a piece of the action, a piece of the decision-making process that is real. And this is not happening in Bahrain. There's no excuse for the country with that kind of income, national income, to have such an impoverished population, and it's no coincidence that this population is primarily Shia. On the other hand, the link between the Sunnis and the Shia, I think, is largely political in the sense it's related to democracy. So the social issues, it would seem to me, are primarily a Shia issue, whereas the democratic demands unify Shia and Sunni. And here I think Iran has a legitimate right and responsibility to intervene on the international stage, at least.
And of course, when we talk about democracy, that's where the United States should come in. But the United States can't afford to lose his longtime ally, Saudi Arabia, because of one thing, and that's the oil. Isn't that true, Dr. Kobani?
Absolutely, but there is also morality and ethics and human rights, which America and the U.S. claim to be the guardian of these issues. So they shouldn't contradict themselves when we see really massacres and killing of barehanded civilians. And actually, I'd like to agree with your lady guest in the U.S. when she said that the popular uprising really in Bahrain was non-sectarian, but it is the rulers in the Gulf area who are playing the sectarian issue, which is a very dangerous issue to divide the people and will destabilize the whole area. Because I'm just hearing voices, for example, in the propaganda machines, which they call media, of these Gulf states, saying that if the Shia citizens of Bahrain are not happy with Al-Khalifa ruling, they could leave the country and go to Iran. This is fascist and discriminatory remarks, which people who mention that or say that should be really tried in court. Because even stupidly, if we talk about the minority Sunni in Bahrain, that if they are not happy, they should leave and go to with their brother in Saudi Arabia, that still would be a fascist and discriminatory remark. So how dare they say that? And also the Muslim in the West, for example, who have got different religion altogether, they have got the decency not to say if Muslims are not happy in Europe or the United States, they can leave and go back to their countries. Those countries in the West and in the US respect human rights. But I wonder why morality and ethics always end at the borders of this country and does not extend to the Middle East while we are seeing all these atrocities committed under their watch.
Let me address that to Jennifer Lowenstein. That's a good question.
It's a very good question, but I have to disagree on one point, and that is that the United States and other Western countries care about human rights up until their own borders end. We have seen enough trouble just in my home state of Wisconsin this past winter with a regime in power in the state that has done more to destroy civil liberties and civil rights of workers and unions, hardworking people, teachers, firemen, police officers, You know, I think we have to tend to our problems right here at home, as well as be a little bit less hypocritical when we're going overseas and talking to other nations and telling them how to run their countries. I agree with the speaker in Beirut that this was not a sectarian struggle initially. I really don't think it was, and that probably if the Khalifa monarchy wanted to institute a few reforms, it could do so very easily. I don't see what the problem is. What I see are very big national security policy issues on the table with the United States and with Saudi Arabia. And I think it should not be forgotten that the Saudi Shia population is in the east, sits on the oil in Saudi Arabia, and has been fiercely discriminated against by Saudi Arabia, and that this could, in fact, lead to regional instability between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So yes, on the one hand, Iran does have an obligation, in a way, to speak for the Shia people. On the other hand, it wouldn't have to if the Shia populations of Saudi Arabia and Bahrain were being treated fairly and with the kind of respect and human dignity that we so often say is part of our legacy.
Okay, we're going to leave it at that. Thank you very much. Associate Director of Mideast Studies Program at the University of Wisconsin, Jennifer Lowenstein, there with her statements. Prior to that, from London, Dr. Ali El-Kabani, who's a journalist and political analyst. We thank you for your statements. And, of course, Dr. Eugene Dibos, who's a chairman of Political Science Department at Notre Dame University in Beirut. We appreciate your statements. And thank you, the viewer, for watching. Send it to questions at newsroom@presstv.ir. From Mikhail Tarvay and the entire team, it's goodbye.